As we look to the next 100 years, it is vital that the Indo-Pacific, a region so central to our shared history, continue to be free and open.
China 21 is produced by the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego's School of Global Policy and Strategy. We are a university-based think tank that produces original research to anchor major policy discussions on China and its relationship to the United States. This podcast features expert voices, insights, and stories about China's economy, politics, society, and the implications for international affairs. Learn more at china.ucsd.edu. Welcome to China 21. I'm your host, Samuel Choi. The clip at the top is of American Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in his recent speech on U.S.-India relations, which frames President Trump's extensive trip to Asia this week, emphasizing the theme of an open and free Indo-Pacific. Today, we have the privilege of hearing from two experts on American power in Asia-Pacific who will offer valuable insights and essential historical context for us to understand implications of this visit. Dr. Michael Green is Senior Vice President for Asia and Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He served on the National Security Council from 2001 through 2005, first as Director for Asian Affairs with responsibility for Japan, Korea, Australia, and New Zealand, and then as Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and Senior Director for Asia, with responsibility for East Asia and South Asia. Dr. Green has authored numerous books and articles on East Asian security, including, most recently, Buy More Than Providence, Grand Strategy and American Power in the Asia-Pacific since 1783. Dr. Stephen Haggard is the Lawrence and Sally Krauss Professor of Korea-Pacific Studies. He is the director of the Korea-Pacific Program and Distinguished Professor of Political Science here at the School of Global Policy and Strategy. He is a go-to expert on current developments in the Asia-Pacific region, particularly the Korean Peninsula, and on the politics of economic reform and globalization. Dr. Haggard has written extensively on the political economy of North Korea and is a prolific contributor to the blog North Korea: Witness to Transformation at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. The following is Dr. Haggard's interview with Dr. Green on President Trump's visit to Asia and how it reflects the recurring themes in the long arc of American strategic thinking.
Mike, thanks for joining us. Let's dive right in. The president's trip is almost unprecedented in length and also in the fact that he's visiting three allies, China, a swing country, and attending no fewer than three summits. So I thought that we might use that to just structure our conversation and walk through it step by step. In your new book, you're a strong advocate for the idea that U.S. policy toward the region should have a really strong U.S.-Japan component. Can you say something about the U.S., the Japan leg of the trip? How did it go?
It seems to have gone well. The president and Prime Minister Abe of Japan have developed a close relationship, which I don't think people would have predicted, because as a candidate, but even going back to the 1980s, Donald Trump was ferociously critical of Japan on trade issues especially. But Abe made an early move to get to know him, stopped in New York, cultivated Melania and his daughter Ivanka and others, and golf. Golf is the secret weapon. So this makes sense for Japan strategically, because Abe doesn't want to show any distance between the U.S. and Japan, is worried a little bit about Trump presidency that tilts too much to China. And it's not bad domestic politics. The Trump support rate in Japan is somewhere around the low 30s, but that's not that much lower than the U.S. So the Japanese public is, you know, somewhat more accepting of our new president than other publics in Asia.
So it seemed to me that one of the things that Abe wanted more than anything else was movement on the economic front. And I think it was fanciful to think that he could budge him back into TPP, but something on trade. That would seem to still be a disappointment, no?
Yeah, I think both sides came away disappointed on trade, but managed not to highlight it too much. Abe disappointed because He, like the Australian Prime Minister, the Singaporeans and others, he didn't see the logic for U.S. interests of pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He knows our domestic politics. 49 of 50 governors supported TPP. I think he figured, you know, eventually this new administration would be coaxed back towards free trade agreements the way, frankly, Obama and Clinton had to be coaxed after their campaign against trade. I think he came away disappointed. I think the president's line on this was, no, we're going to reduce bilateral trade deficits. That's our focus. But I think he came away probably a bit disappointed because the Japanese side did not agree to a bilateral free trade agreement, which the president thinks is necessary to get rid of the bilateral trade deficits. That's a debatable assertion, but that's what he came in trying to achieve. He didn't get it either. But, you know, both sides kind of let that go for the most part because their real challenge is North Korea.
A little bit of a surprise before we turn to North Korea was the president's mention of arms sales as a way of achieving some strategic objectives, but also economic ones. Do you have any comment on what we might actually be selling them?
Well, we have a quite successful range of exports to Japan, and aerospace and defense is very high on the list, together with agriculture and services. And the president, if he wants to reduce the bilateral trade deficit, logically wants to sell more stuff. I think politically, the president, wanted to be able to tweet back that he was, you know, selling more American stuff in Asia. That's not normally what an American president does. That's normally what the prime minister of a small European country does in Asia, is trade missions and selling stuff. Usually the U.S. has a bigger portfolio of more strategic issues, but this president's very focused on demonstrating relative increases in our trade, and even really relative gains, to use the theoretical term, reducing trade deficits.
Absolutely.
Almost at the, you know, whether or not it expands, you know, welfare for all. So it's a pretty strong meme for him. But in substantive terms, I don't think there was any real a collision on this, just disappointment.
Right. Well, let's turn to Korea. Obviously, North Korea is looming large over the entire trip. But before we turn to that question, there's also been this interesting conversation that's been going on among some of us, yourself included, on South Korea-China relations in advance of the trip. Do you want to fill us in on that?
So historically, as you know better than I, Korea is the shrimp between whales. The Korean Peninsula has been what many historians call the cockpit of Asia, not the place where pilots fly, but where the, you know, the birds are thrown in to fight it out. It's where Japan, China, Russia, the U.S., Europe, the big powers play out their rivalries. It's the place where the major wars of the 19th and 20th century, almost all of them, started. Means that Korea is in a very awkward position. I think that fundamentally the U.S.-Korea alliance is very strong. Look, I was in the Bush White House for 5 years, and we had terrible headlines about the relationship between George Bush and Nomu-hyun. And I used to, you know, joke to the press and to the president that, you know, the U.S.-Korea alliance was like the music of Richard Wagner, or what Mark Twain said, you know, it's not as bad as it sounds. And, you know, the substance was quite strong, and Korean polls about the U.S. then and now are very, very good, actually, if you look at the Korean press polling. And the common values as democracies, that's a pretty strong bond. But the geopolitical position of Korea means they cannot do what Japan is doing, or Australia or India, or a major offshore power that's separated from China by oceans. Korea's separated by rivers that are pretty easy to cross. So they're in a difficult position. The Moon Jae-in administration has probably made things somewhat worse because he's a decent man, a mild-mannered guy, but he presides over a very divided party. He doesn't have a majority in the National Assembly. There are, in his circle, some very far-left sympathizers in North Korea. There are also some very pragmatic foreign policy realists. And that, you know, has been a source of trouble because it appears that the foreign minister reached an agreement with the Chinese side over how to move past this squabble the two countries are having on the deployment of American missile defense systems, THAAD, to Korea, and China's embargo, quite illegal embargo and boycott of Lotte and other Korean companies in response. And the Korean side, you know, it wasn't going anywhere. The Koreans held pretty firm, actually. The Chinese wanted to move forward. The Koreans wanted to move forward. They basically, as I understand it, from both sides, well, from the Korean side, they agreed to disagree. They acknowledged each other's disagreements. It's essentially what Abe did with Xi Jinping before his first summit with him in 2014. But then the Chinese side came out and said, aha, the Koreans have agreed to these conditions before we move forward. No American missile defense, no trilateral alliance with Japan and Korea. And the Moon administration really bungled it. They didn't do what the U.S. or Australia or Japan did in similar circumstances, which is to immediately clarify what had been agreed on. Instead, they rather reluctantly put out statements, tried to, you know, disassemble in the National Assembly without offending the U.S. or China. In some ways, it's a kind of tragically classical Korean strategic cultural fault, trying not to get caught in big power rivalries and making them worse. I think at the end of the day, it showed a certain amount of weakness to China that the Koreans will regret and that will color the president's trip. Although we're speaking as he's in Korea, and we haven't heard his speech yet in the National Assembly, so we'll see. I think the Korea relationship historically for the U.S. and the Korean Peninsula for the U.S. has always been a blind spot strategically. The great American strategic thinkers like Mahan, Kennan, never understood how important Korea was to the overall order and stability in Asia. They saw it as part of the continent and didn't want to get too embroiled. And we're kind of replaying that mistake again in the Trump-Moon relationship. And hopefully they'll start to patch it up and we'll find out.
Well, let's shift over to the North Korean question. Obviously, you've got three countries that are going to play a critical role in this, the United States, South Korea, and China. And it's funny because it seems to me that there are strategic objectives in terms of denuclearization are aligned, but the tactical differences are fairly intense. Secretaries Mattis and Tillerson have been continuing to talk about negotiations. The president obviously is on and off that page. What do you think the chances are that there'll be some sort of breakthrough on the North Korean issue among those three parties on this trip?
Very close to zero, to be honest. I've been working on this problem not as long as you have, perhaps, Professor, but since I ran a task force on it in the Council on Foreign Relations 20 years ago, and I had a leading role coordinating North Korea policy in the Bush White House, and I joke that I've personally solved the North Korea problem at least four times. And in a way, we all have. We've all thought, you know, with the six-party talks, with the four-party talks, with the agreed framework, all of which I supported and some of which I worked on. I think we're, based on the open, unclassified literature, a year to two away from North Korea having a nuclear warhead they can put on a missile that reaches the U.S. and survives reentry into the atmosphere and blows up somewhere. And they're not going to get off of that. They're going to keep pushing forward. Will we have diplomacy after that? Yeah, maybe. But at that point, what are we negotiating? I mean, the North Koreans would like to negotiate what they call an arms control agreement, sort of like we had with the Soviets. And I was in Pyongyang in 2002 for one of our direct negotiations with the North Koreans, and they laid out pretty clearly their demands, which were an end to all sanctions, an end to our nuclear umbrella over Japan and Korea, economic aid, legitimacy for the regime. Is the U.S. capable of doing that, just politically? Would Japan accept that? Would even South Korea accept that? I don't see how we are able to put together an agreement that's sustainable on the side of the U.S. or Japan or Korea. And then on the North Korean side, and you've made this point, I think, this is the stalker state, right? This is not the Soviet Union. This is a regime that has no interest in a stable equilibrium or stable arms control. They want, like a mafia, you know, thug driving the truck through the store window and demanding more money, they want constant tension and insecurity so they can keep driving up the price. And possibly, this is debated, possibly creating conditions, at least in their mind, where they can liberate the South. That seems pretty ridiculous to us, but I don't think we should underestimate how important it is to the internal logic and propaganda of what the North's reason for existence is. So I just don't know how you put together an agreement. Maybe we can get some tactical agreements for a temporary freeze, for something like that. But I think a grand bargain is now behind us. I really am afraid that the only way we get a significant reduction of the threat is when that regime is gone. Yeah.
Well, no president of the United States is going to sit down and negotiate on a peace regime without addressing the denuclearization issue.
Right.
I mean, that's obvious. So the question may come down to how far you think China will go.
Yeah.
And since that's the next leg of the trip, maybe we can pick up that piece. Is your view that the Chinese posture with respect to North Korea is fundamentally changing, or do you think that they're basically in the same kind of holding pattern that we've seen over the last 10 years?
So I'm not primarily a China expert. I'm a Japan expert who, like Meiji and Taisho Japan, expanded from there, learned Korea, and then started doing China, Southeast Asia, India. But I did work on this, and I did, in and out of government, participate in numerous talks with the Chinese, official and unofficial, about North Korea. I think that the Chinese under Xi Jinping are harder on the North Koreans. The problem has become harder. Xi is a more confident leader. Hu Jintao, I can tell you, in 2005, was sent with a letter from President Bush to Hu Jintao. I was just a messenger, but I was brought in to see him. It was not the only occasion I got to see him with just one or two U.S. officials, and Hu Jintao was very dismissive of Kim Jong-il, thought he was a punk. But the system and Hu's own weak leadership constrained his action. Xi Jinping obviously is more confident and more open about his disregard for Kim Jong-un. And I think has done more, clearly, in sanctions in the Security Council, in financial sanctions. In that sense, there's more being done by China. In Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin's era, it was a very high priority for those leaders to keep cooperation in North Korea as a major theme in the U.S.-China relationship.
Exactly.
I don't think that's true in the same way anymore.
Oh, you don't?
No. I think if you look at... we should ask Susan Shirk, but I think if you look at Xi's 19th Party Congress 3.5-hour diatribe, but quite intelligent and revealing diatribe, no mention of North Korea, exactly. And no mention of the U.S., really. China is moving out on its own. So I think the importance of satisfying the U.S. may have gone down, even as Xi Jinping's own willingness to pressure North Korea has gone up somewhat. And then the third element that I think ties it all together is, I think that China's view is that in the long run, Xi Jinping is a Marxist. He's a Leninist. He's a very good Leninist, but he's also a student of Marx, and he believes in dialectical materialism. And I think he looks at trading figure patterns. 80%, I think, of North Korea's trade is with China.
Higher
now. And South Korea trades more than the U.S., than it does, more with China than it does with the U.S. and Japan combined. That ignores foreign direct investment, which I think is a very, very important counter narrative. But still, I think that in Zhenanghai, in leadership ranks, the assumption is time is on China's side, and eventually they will have the traditional, millennia-old or millennia-long Chinese influence over the entire peninsula. So rather than push North Korea to the point of collapse and play into an American strategy, I think the incentives are for China to play this one out over the long haul, because they will accrue more influence over both Koreas, be able to control this in a way that the threat to them is minimized and the American influence and Japanese influence is marginalized. And Kim Jong-un is spoiling that strategy, and the ability of the U.S. to demonstrate to China that North Korea's actions are ruining China's assumptions, that actually our alliances are getting stronger, not weaker, is important. But that gets back to your question about the China-South Korea agreement that is being debated now, because is that a sign that this strategy that the U.S., which is, by the way, the strategy of Clinton, Bush, and Obama, too, is bipartisan, is this Jain agreement with China a signal that that's not going to work? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think probably it will work, but it gives some comfort to the Chinese in their assumptions and their complacency, frankly. And so that's sort of how I see the Chinese perspective shifting.
Well, look, in microcosm, your answer to that question raises what to me is actually the central question, which is what the United States approach for dealing with China is. And in your book, you make this very interesting point that we've shifted back and forth between grand strategies which focus on getting the U.S.-China relationship right and those that see the U.S.-China relationship in terms of our capacity to build coalitions around China's rim. So where do you think the Trump administration is in that debate?
So this is a president who came into office with an anti-everybody narrative. anti-China, anti-Japan, anti-everybody. So, and it played well. Equal opportunity, and it played well. You know, he won the election with that that motif that he's going to fight harder than anybody because he's going to fight everybody. In policy and in strategy, you have to make choices. You have to make priorities. I think you can see that there's been something of a shift. Initially, the president's tweets, the president's statements, the role of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as a conduit for Chinese officials and strategic discussions all pointed to the possibility of a very transactional president reaching a grand bargain with China, centered on North Korea, on China doing more for North Korea. And the president tweeted, I can give you a good deal on trade if you help out North Korea. Right. And the Taiwanese started thinking, gosh, are we next? Are you going to give a good deal on Taiwan? And the Japanese were worried and the Indians. I think that concern has subsided. And part of the reason is that there's a national security team that's much more traditional, very Republican, very much in the tradition of Alfred Thayer Mahan and George Shultz and Reagan. And I would add Hillary Clinton and certain Democrats. And Joe Nye, exactly. I mean, this is bipartisan, exactly. Two bald guys, you know. Joe Nye and Rich Armitage are really the intellectual leaders of this idea that to get China right, we have to get Asia right. We have to play to our strengths and then approach, don't contain China, but approach China from a position of strength based on rejection of a G2 or a new model of great power relations or a condominium with China, and essentially inviting China to play by rules we've established. That's a hard discussion, but you're better off, and I am in this camp too, if your alliances are strong, and that's why Japan's important. I think that general outlook is reflected in the speech Rex Tillerson gave, which is now the theme for the president's trip, or one of the themes, which is this idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific. That's very Mahanian, it's very Navy, it's very, Joe Nye and Rich Armitage, although they may not want to own it.
Can you speak to what you think that means?
Well, I think it means that that Secretary of Defense Mattis, John Kelly, the Chief of Staff, Marine four-star, both maritime service, leaders, come at this from a maritime kind of allies-focused approach. Makes a lot of sense. And I think McMaster's there, too. Army guy, but, I think that's where he and his NSC staff are. Tillerson I wasn't sure about, but I think Tillerson's speech at CSIS was very revealing. He has, famously limited connection to the Foreign Service. But he has a very strong team in policy planning in his immediate sort of kitchen cabinet. Brian Hook is the guy who runs it. And I think those were the people who developed this concept. And it very much is rooted in a traditional American maritime strategy. And I think they mean it. That said, I think there are a couple problems with it that are going to be pretty obvious and already are on this trip. One is, this Mahanian, George Shultz, Nye Armitage concept is based on an open trading regime in Asia. Yeah. If you have a zero sum, and the White House briefer said, we got two big themes, free and open Asia Pacific and America First. Well, I'm sorry, but those don't go together. Because the America First is a very transactional theme focused on our relative gains, us getting a better deal, rather than creating an open set of rules that ultimately is designed to get China to play by the rules. And so that's a big, it's sort of like a sandwich with no bologna inside. That's a big problem, that they don't have a trade component to this free and open Indo-Pacific. They have a trade theme, but it contradicts their strategic theme. The other problem, and this may be the historian in me overthinking this, but the advocates of maritime strategy, not Joe Nye and Rich Armitage, but historically, Kennan, Mahan, they didn't want anything to do with Korea, right? As I was discussing earlier, they saw it as part of the continent. We shape from offshore. There's an ambivalence about Korea. I think, and I think you would agree, that Korea is probably the most important sort of pivotal piece of Asia's puzzle. Japan's not going China's way. India's not going China's way. And I don't think Australia is. Korea is a very, very important geopolitical piece of this game. And I don't think I think the alliance is strong with the U.S., but the Chinese clearly think Korea's in play. And so that's it's not clear how that fits in this free and open Indo-Pacific. And I think if the Secretary of Defense or State were here, they would say, and they'd believe it, no, Korea's an ally. This is important. But one of the manifestations of the free and open Indo-Pacific idea is that in Manila, at the end of the trip, the U.S., Japan, India, and Australia are going to do a quadrilateral strategic dialogue. When that was first, and I support that, but when it was first proposed by Abe in 2007, the Korean government was strongly opposed. And I'm pretty sure they opposed it this time, but they're just not in a strong enough position in Washington to get their voice heard. And I suspect that within the administration, there's frustration with Moon, uncertainty about Korea, and therefore an enthusiasm for going ahead with this quad without thinking through the Korea piece. And of course, the other part of it is, if we were worried about Korea, we would not be threatening to pull out of CORUS, the free trade agreement. It's not like TPP, where we're not in it yet. That's damaging enough, but we're already in CORUS. And if we want to, I mean, I can tell you, when the idea of a Korea free trade agreement first came up, I was in the White House. I was on the NSC staff. And it was first proposed by Kurt Tong, a very capable foreign service officer, now one of the best examples of foreign service, now consul general in Hong Kong. And he sent a cable back, which in retrospect, maybe I'm not allowed to talk about, but he said, look, I've been talking to the Korean trade officials. There may be interest in doing a free trade agreement. So we created a little cell in the White House with USTR, Treasury, State. I was in it. My role was to think through whether we wanted to do this politically and strategically. And we all agreed yes, because we need to demonstrate a long-term commitment to Korea and integration of our economies and agreeing on a set of rules, because the Chinese think Korea's in play, because Korea's part of the rule making that we champion. And that was, I think, the right decision. So threatening to pull out of CORUS has all the opposite signal effects.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think the president is serious. I think he's prepared to leave CORUS. I don't think anybody in his cabinet agrees. Pretty sure about that. there's one professor from this part of the world that probably wants to pull out of CORUS who's advising the president. But
you disown him.
Okay. Although I'm not even sure about his position. But basically, it's a gratuitous thing. I think that pulling out of NAFTA was suicidal. It sounded good on the campaign trail. White House decided we can't possibly do that. It would destroy our own voters in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio. So Korea looked like an easy, cheap scalp CORUS. I think that's wrong, but it is still in peril. And that reflects sort of the unfilled spaces in this free and Indo-Pacific. It's the right strategic concept, but it has these big contradictions that are going to come out on this trip.
Well, that actually pivots us down to the next leg of the visit, because the comments you've made about Korea obviously resonate with how we're going to approach the whole Southeast Asia region as a whole, and India beyond that. And so one possible hook for this kind of strategy would be adequate strategic concern in Southeast Asia with China's rise, that we could play on that to our advantage if you're a proponent of this Mahanian strategy.
Yeah.
So can you give us your overview of what you think the Southeast Asian picture looks like?
I don't think I was in Singapore a little over a week ago. I don't think the Southeast Asians know the answer to that question. I think it's a great big blank space. And so the president's actual visit is going to be very important in terms of the impressions he makes, the commitments he makes or doesn't make. It's not surprising. Very few presidents come into office thinking about Southeast Asia. American strategy is fundamentally about Northeast Asia. And every president, except perhaps Obama, who lived in Indonesia, came in kind of figuring out Southeast Asia on the job, having generally thought harder about Japan, China, North Korea, India. So, give him a little bit of a pass. He has had summits with at least four Southeast Asian leaders, which is, I think, a record. For this point in an administration.
Some of them somewhat controversial.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's right.
Thailand, Malaysia.
Well, so here's the thing. We are not going to get an alliance with ASEAN We have two treaty allies within ASEAN, but we're not going to get an alliance with ASEAN. And we're barely able to get ASEAN to agree with themselves on what to do about China, because Beijing can reach inside the tent through Cambodia or Laos and block consensus. So it's going to have to be a differentiated strategy. We're going to have to think on several dimensions. One thing that they almost all want to see is American resolve. And I think, actually, Trump gets more credit here than Obama. Our freedom of navigation operations, our willingness to send destroyers, frigates into the South China Sea is clearer now to the region. So I think actually probably better than it was under the Obama administration. On the other hand, they don't want a heavy American military presence. They want it primarily to be about trade and business. And they want an answer to China's Belt and Road Initiative and rather aggressive and mercantilist infrastructure proposals, which the Southeast Asians would like to counter with Japanese or American proposals. The Japanese are playing that game a little bit with what they call high-quality infrastructure. Our answer is kind of apples and oranges, but our answer is TPP investment. We have far more foreign direct investment in Southeast Asia than China does. And TPP is kind of about that, even though it doesn't include all the ASEAN countries. So again, trade, we don't have a good story to tell. And then the question you raise, which is, what is our position on human rights and democracy? And the president is bragging that he's going to have a better relationship with some of these leaders than President Obama, because he's not going to raise human rights and democracy. Mm-hmm. That may get you a short-term good relationship, but in the long run, I think it's a strategic mistake. We need states in Southeast Asia that are resilient, which means we need states that are well-governed, which means they're transparent and accountable. If we're worried about terrorism, and we should be, again, in Southeast Asia, if we're worried about undue Chinese influence, you know, non-transparent, corrupt Chinese influence, the answer to that is more civil society, a freer press, more accountable governments. In almost every country in the region, the trend is in the wrong direction. So, you know, in the short term, yeah, well, you know, the president can have better relations if he doesn't raise these issues. In the medium to long term, it's going to end up with a set of governments and a governance structure and a closing civil society that makes all these states much more vulnerable. And that's a strategic liability for us. So it's not an easy, you know, it's not easy to get this right. But I think the president's wrong to chortle about having better relations because he's ignoring human rights and democracy. I also think he will have a very hard time sustaining his policy because Congress has pretty strong feelings about this. And so, you know, a very mixed picture on Southeast Asia. If the theme is our strategy is about not raising human rights and democracy, it's not going to work. So we'll see. I think Congress is already starting to mobilize around those issues. It's interesting, the Congress in most of most of the history of the Congress is usually the variable that causes trouble. But nowadays, Congress is weighing in on issues that are
acting as a check.
Actually quite a helpful check or a reminder of our interests.
Well, this actually segues perfectly into the last stage of the trip. I was going to ask you about the choice of Vietnam and the visit to Da Nang, but I think what's interesting is he ends in the Philippines, which raises all of the questions you've just talked about, but also is a really fraught relationship, obviously, and one which is proximate to the challenges that China's posing in the South China Sea. What do you expect to see there?
Well, our standing with the Philippine public, with the foreign ministry, the defense forces, is actually quite good. You know, there's urban combat in the south of the Philippines, and it's our guys who are helping the armed forces of the Philippines beat the bad guys. They have no air force. They're procuring some trainers, and they have a few Huey helicopters. They know that it's the U.S. and Japan increasingly that are providing surveillance and maritime domain awareness, you know, letting them know in their 1,000-plus islands what's transpiring. So there's a pretty strong recognition of the importance of the U.S. and especially Japan. Abe and Duterte have a very close relationship. But Duterte himself has a real bee in his bonnet about the U.S. And it's personal, it's deep, and I've had various Filipino friends explain it to me. You know, if any American president is going to get along with him, it probably is Donald Trump. So maybe he'll get a dialogue going. We will not be able to turn a blind eye to the extrajudicial killings, which go beyond just killing drug, you know, lords to killing political opponents. And it's a very dark cloud over democracy and civil society in the Philippines. And we have a stake in that. We have some dark history, but we also have some pretty important history helping support democracy in the Philippines, right?
Aquino.
Exactly. So, and there are a lot of members of Congress and a lot of Filipino Americans who care about this. So I know what I would advise the president. I would say have a candid, develop a good relationship with Duterte. Find some ways to show him you're committed to the Philippines. But find a very quiet way to have a discussion with him about how important this is, and try to think of some follow-up measures, like members of Congress and others. We used to have Senator Stevens from Alaska and Inouye from Hawaii. So when I was in the White House, President Bush could deliver kind of a tough message, and then he could ask Stevens and Inouye, "Could you go and tell Chen Shui-bian in Taiwan or whoever what the Congress thinks?" And they were good at it. We don't quite have that now in the Congress. We have some very good younger members. But I would look for some ways for people he trusts, Americans he trusts, to follow up and keep the dialogue going. And not look for overnight change, because that won't happen. Duterte is pretty stubborn. But work it and engage. The president's staying for the East Asia Summit. He wasn't going to. That's a really long trip. I think Duterte will appreciate that. I think the Filipino people will appreciate that. That, you know, he's got a position to start talking about this stuff if he wants to. Listening to him, President Trump, I don't think he wants to. This just isn't something he thinks is important, as far as I can tell.
Well, that actually leads to my last question. First, let me say it's just been tremendously enjoyable talking to you about this. But, you know, this is a president who almost made his career on being anti-multilateral. And in your book, you make a very interesting point that multilateralism can't substitute for having a grand strategy which involves these traditional alliance relationships and so on. But lo and behold, the president is going to be sitting in on no fewer than three, if I'm counting correctly, summits.
Yeah.
Do you think that the multilateral piece is something that Donald Trump can convince the region of his intentions on?
It
certainly seems to be something that's a part of this trip.
Yeah, I mean, there's good news and bad news. The good news is Donald Trump doesn't feel threatened by APEC, by the East Asia Summit, or by the U.S.-ASEAN Summit. He doesn't. That's the good news. The bad news is that's because there's not that much there. I mean, his assault, the Steve Bannon assault on the EU, for example, on NAFTA, is about loss of sovereignty. I think part of the comfort level that the president has with these multilateral meetings is it's pretty obvious they're not affecting sovereignty. So he'll get points and deserves them. That's a long trip. But I'm not sure this is a vision for building an effective multilateral architecture in Asia, which, as I say in the book and as a realist I always argue, is complementary or supplemental to the logic of balance of power, but indispensable. And, you know, one of the when I thought about multilateralism in my job in the White House, I thought about it one way. When I went back and started looking at the history of American responses to multilateralism, I started thinking about it differently. So, we introduced multilateralism in Asia in the 1920s, actually in the turn of the century with the Open Door Note, and then in the 1920s with the Washington Naval Treaty. We, the Americans, were the originators of the idea that there should be a multilateral approach to Asia. And then, you know, we rejected that in the Cold War for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons the U.S. became active on this, even before the Cold War was over, under Ronald Reagan, for example, was not out of idealism or even necessarily a belief that this would work, but out of a recognition that there would be a competition for how you organize Asia. And the first warning was Bandung non-alignment in 1955, and we bungled that. You know, the Eisenhower administration's approach was there is no non-alignment. You're with us or the communists. Kennedy came in with a much more nuanced approach. We've always rightly been worried that if we don't have a vision for a trans-Pacific architecture of some kind, there's going to be an impulse within Asia, and sometimes from people who wish us ill, to organize some kind of regional architecture that is intra-Asian, the Chinese favored Bandung under Mao, the Soviets favored multilateralism. Gorbachev in 1985 gave this speech about the need for multilateralism. He's very idealistic. You know, the Soviets said, why do we have bilateral alliances in Asia? We need multilateralism. Xi Jinping gave a speech in 2014 in Shanghai in April, almost the same language. Why do we need bilateral alliances? Why do we need blocs? we Asians can create. So there is a kind of competition balance of power dimension to how we should be thinking about this. If we don't have a vision for a trans-Pacific architecture, then shame on us, because others will fill that space. I don't think the president's participation in EAS or APEC fills that space. It definitely prevents a vacuum. If he hadn't gone, there would have been a vacuum, and China would have tried to fill it. But they clearly don't yet have a vision for what, you know, what goes in that space. Maybe, you know, the last three presidents went to Asia with one idea about the region and came back with a different one. Now, Clinton's first trip in 93, he went out with a very different vision of Japan and China. Came back, you know, he was a smart, he learns fast. Contextual intelligence, as Joe Nye says. And he adjusted quite successfully. Obama went out and got an earful about TPP and CORUS, and he adjusted. Bush, I was with Bush, he went after 9/11. So it was a little different because it was all about fighting terrorism. But the pattern is presidents go out, they get all these ideas campaigning. You know, academics come in and say, this is how the world works. Diplomats have another view. The Pentagon has another view. They go out, and that's quite an education.
Yeah.
12 days talking to leaders in Asia, being briefed by our military commanders, watching the demonstrators through the window. They learn. You know, does Donald Trump learn? I think that's more of a question than it was with his predecessors, for sure. But I think to some extent we'll see some adjustments. I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we have to wrap up. We're taping prior to the president's speech, or it's about to be made right now to the National Assembly in Korea, and we'll learn more about the Indo-Pacific strategy. But Mike Green, thanks very
Thank
much
you.
For coming to UCSD. We really appreciate you
great,
doing
great
this.
Being here. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to China 21, the podcast of the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Visit china.ucsd.edu and connect with us on social media. 谢谢大家。